Thank you. All right. Case number 5, 11-1532, Munson versus Gates. Hi, Mr. Carter.
Good morning, Your Honors. Madam Chief, Your Honors, may it please the Court, Counsel. Before I begin, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Sure thing.
Now, chiefly at issue in this case is whether a pro se prisoner's First Amendment claim, and in this case his claim is that he was denied access to 2 books, whether that claim can be dismissed, not based on any record evidence, but instead on what a district court could imagine. Now, I think there's several courts throughout the country, including several decisions from this circuit, that indicate that the answer to that question is no. And there's 2 reasons that the district court should be reversed in this case. First, there's no record evidence to establish a reasonable relationship between a legitimate and specific penological interest and the prison restriction that's at issue here.
Well, wait a minute, though. Your client attached to his complaint the administrative treatment of his claim for these 2 books, and it specifically points to these items being detrimental to security, good order, rehabilitation, so forth, and drugs. Isn't that the specific part of the record that the district judge refers to when he talks about the potential misuse for those books?
Well, Your Honor, I think that the problem with the form letter that Mr. Munson received is that clause that you cite is basically the catch-all clause. It says that it is, as you said.
There is sort of a catch-all, but then there's the specific drugs listing where it appears to be typed in on that line. And these are drug books. These are books about drugs. And the screening that was done at the prison was selective. There were 6 books ordered, and 4 got through, but these 2 particular ones related to drugs were excluded.
Well, I don't think there's any question that these books deal with drugs, but the problem is there's been no connection between any one of the penological interests shown and what these books could be used for that relates to drugs.
But what leap of logic is needed to demonstrate that access to books that detail harmful drug combinations or doses might lead to criminal activity in a prison? I mean, those 2 things seem directly related. I think the connection, you know, is self-evident. And all of that information is contained in the complaint itself.
Well, I think one problem with that, first of all, I think it takes a leap that I still don't believe that the record evidence supports. It takes a leap to say that these books could be used for some detrimental purpose. And that's particularly the case here when you consider that other inmates have these types of books in their cells, and also
What do you mean by types of books?
Mr. Munson in his complaint alleges
that
inmates have these types of books in their cell.
Well, but they actually have physician's desk reference and the complete drug reference in their cells?
It's not clear from the record whether that's the case. However, he also alleges that these books were in the prison library. And he alleges that not only were they in the prison library, but some inmates are able to make copies of those books, or at least portions of the books, and take them back to their cell.
What started all of this is that he got somebody else's medicine, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay. What was he hoping to determine by having these books?
He alleges that he's hoping to determine and to take more responsibility for his medical health. He was very obviously unhappy, and it was a very, very trying time for him.
That mistake is serious.
Right.
So what's his remedy? How are having these books going to solve that problem?
I think that what he wants these books for is that so he can monitor his own health and his own, his drug intake and the side effects that some of the drugs that he takes might have.
Well, if these books are in the library, he certainly has that alternative. And if he alleges it, I think that he could copy parts of those books in the library.
Well, he alleges that they are available for copying. However, he was never allowed to make copies. because of the prison librarian's unwillingness to help him, and also because of frequent prison lockdowns.
There's some confusion, at least for me, that what they do with these books. One said something about went to his family, some went back, I don't know, to whom. Do you know what?
It's my understanding that the books went back to his family.
Yeah, well, why can't he communicate with them? Hey, look this up. Here's what I'm getting, and what are the side effects? They could easily go to the druggist and find out. I think the problem was that he got somebody else's medicine. I don't know that he had a quarrel with the medicine he was getting, but I can understand why he wants to know this about it. You get old like me, you start taking pills, and you look at the side effects and the warnings, you wonder if you should not take it. So,
yes,
you know, what are you going to do? What was his problem? What was he taking all this stuff for?
He suffers from several medical problems, but most seriously, he suffers from AIDS.
AIDS?
Yes.
Okay, well, that's pretty complicated.
Right. So the district court in this case said that it could imagine a connection between the penological interest and the prison restriction here. And
I know that term, that word, imagine was used, but as Judge Rovner points out, they're really, it doesn't take any imagination when you're thinking about a prison environment and drugs. That's like dynamite let loose.
And I think this goes to the point that the Attorney General has argued, and that's that common sense in some cases can be used to establish the connection between a legitimate penological interest and a prison restriction. But the problem is that in all of the cases that the Attorney General has cited, those cases all came to the court with more record evidence than what we have here. They came
summary judgment cases or cases that reached the court process later in the process.
That's correct.
Some discovery that I'll certainly grant you that.
And also in several of those cases, even though there was more evidence, the appellate court reversed and sent the cases back for more evidence. In the Wolf case, which is a Third Circuit case, the court said that a prison cannot support its restriction with mere conclusory assertions. And in the Ramirez case, the Third Circuit said that just citing a broad goal, and in that case it was rehabilitation, is not enough. The prison administrator has to cite some specific rehabilitative goal that is furthered by the prison restriction. And if you look at the form here, there are check marks that you can make on this prison form. It's at A27 that are far more specific and detailed than the catch-all provision that was cited in this case. For example, there is the box that says encourage or instruct the commission of criminal activity. Well, if in this case Mr. Munson sought the complete guide to making drugs in prison or the complete guide to building a bomb in prison, well, I don't think there's any question that they could check that form and that would be enough. But when you cite every penological interest, basically, in the catch-all provision, and you don't provide any explanation other than the word drugs, that's a different case. And the reason is that I think that it's very necessary to have some meaningful judicial review. And this court has said that there's obviously deference paid, great deference paid to prison administrators, but that deference has to be schooled, not absolute. And in the Ramirez case, the Third Circuit says that a prisoner's constitutional rights can't be left to the pleasure of their custodians. And before I finish, one other point that is very important in this case is that the district court's opinion creates new pleading requirements that aren't specifically provided in the PLRA or under usual procedural practices. So now a prisoner doesn't have to just show that he has a prima facie constitutional claim. He also has to show that he can rebut any one of the reasonable or common sense or potential connections a court or a prison administrator may have thought of when they check the catch-all box. And I think that's more than the PLRA requires.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wichern? Did I pronounce that correctly?
Close enough, Wichern, but my second name is Wichern because everybody calls me that. I'm here on behalf of the Attorney General of Illinois, Lisa Madigan. In light of counsel's argument today, I will address only Mr. Munson's First Amendment claim, unless, of course, the Court has questions about his Eighth and Fourteenth Amendment claim. And please excuse me, I'm getting over a cold. As has been discussed this morning, the ultimate question under Turner is whether the restriction on Mr. Munson's personal possession of these two books is reasonably related to a legitimate penological interest.
You know what the biggest problem here? It's that the case was dismissed during screening, and long before he had any opportunity to develop his case. And none of the cases, of course, on which you rely, it seems to me, are from the screening stage.
A couple responses to that. As we know, Mr. Munson pled the legitimate penological interest in his complaint. That puts this case on different footing than this Court's cases in Lindell, Ortiz, and King right off the bat. So the fact that it was at screening is, you know, an interesting point, but he also pled those interests in his complaint. Given that, now the burden was on him to allege enough to plausibly suggest that those reasons were irrational and unreasonable. And that's where his complaint fell down.
But will any prisoner be able to overcome the boilerplate language that prisons give about prison security and order and discipline, you know, at the screening stage?
I have a couple responses to that. For example, in this Court's decisions in Reed and Scheimer, there were reasons put forward. It's not you can't have dreadlocks because that might promote prison violence. And this Court said, you know, the link between those two is not commonsensical. So there will be cases where the Court will not be able to make this determination, even if the prisoner pleads those interests. Perhaps the link between security and the restriction that was placed on the prisoner's rights won't be commonsensical. And that's, you know, the value of this test that is measured and case-dependent. It allows the Court to do that in instances where common sense can fill the gap, but allow cases to go forward past screening in cases where there might be a question. And here, Mr. Munson's allegations did not suggest that the reasons for the restriction here were unreasonable.
Well, does it make a difference that he alleged that the books are available to him in the library and that some other books got through that he'd ordered?
He made the allegation that some other prisoners have similar kinds of books, but in order to show or to suggest at the pleading stage that that kind of differential treatment would be illogical or unreasonable, he would have to allege something maybe temporal, like a month ago another prisoner was allowed to have these same books, even though they're on the disapproved list, and that prisoner was, for example, convicted of drug crime. So allowing him to have it and not me to have it would suggest unreasonableness. But here the allegations are so vague that we cannot infer that he would be able to plausibly show unreasonableness from the allegation that some other prisoners have similar kinds of books. You know, that's all we know from his allegations. I would point the Court to the D.C. Circuit's decision in Amatel. Even though it was at summary judgment, regardless of the procedural posture, the Court overruled the District Court's permanent injunction against the Ensign Amendment and said no evidence was needed to determine that not allowing the inmates there to have adult magazines was reasonably related to a legitimate penological interest. So despite the procedural posture, even though the case was at summary judgment and there was evidence, the Court overruled the District Court's decision based on common sense. So the fact that there haven't been that many cases, you know, whether they're at summary judgment, trial, or at the pleading stage, I don't think is dispositive of this Court's decision here. As we noted, this is, at least to our research, the first time the Court's been asked to clarify at the pleading stage, once the inmate has alleged the legitimate penological interest in the complaint, again, unlike the court's decisions in Lindell, King, and Ortiz, what burden under Twombly and Iqbal does the prisoner have at that point to overcome the presumption of reasonableness at the pleading stage? And unless the court has any questions, we ask that you affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you very much. Thank you. How much time? 1 minute. Can you do it?
Yes.
Okay.
Your Honors, I don't believe that the Lindell case, the King case, or the Ortiz case, or any of the other cases that the Attorney General cites, support a shifting burden to the prisoner plaintiff. If the burden shifts, he's got to have some reasonable basis to believe what the connection is that he's rebutting. Here, he doesn't know whether he's rebutting a connection to rehabilitation, order, discipline, or anything else. And one last point is that King is a very, very, I think, strong case for the plaintiff, because in King, it was a denial of a book. The book was related to computer programming. The denial was supported by the notion that computer programming could harm prison security. However, the appellate court, the Seventh Circuit, sent it back and said, well, it was just piling conjecture upon conjecture because there's no showing that this book could cause any problems to prison security. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And you took this case on as a pro bono case. You certainly have the thanks of the court. And you did a splendid job. And you did too. But he did a free splendid job. Okay. So,